moment of insanity, I volunteered to summarize this chapter for our reading group. My hope is that if we take turns in doing this, that this could be useful. And if it's not useful, well, then I've just wasted 15 minutes of your time. So this is chapter 2 of Exclusion and Embrace. It's the chapter on exclusion. In some books, I know this is chapter 3. Then also the page numbers that you see in front of you are the page numbers in my book. They may not be the same in yours, but hopefully it allows you to map this into your book. It's the chapter of on exclusion, so it's the difficult chapter, right? It's the chapter about everything that goes wrong. Here are basically the subheadings of that chapter, and the three words that you see underlined are what I think Wolf is trying to mainly get to. But even if you just look at the way this is structured, you can see that he doesn't get there in a straight line. He finds a lot of rabbit holes to go and explore a little bit. So I've kept those headings as I go through these slides. First of all, he talked about the dubious triumph of inclusion. My attempt at a summary of this section is that Wolf says, watch your narrative, because, you know, we like to have our narratives of, you know, we are the civilized ones, the inclusive ones, whatever. Those other people, they're the savages, they're the exclusionists. By the way, that quote is not a Wolf quote, it's just me giving a simplistic summary of it. Wolf says and briefly makes the case for the fact that the West's inclusive democracies have been built actually on an exclusion of colossal proportions, as he calls it. So yes, the West has been able to achieve a lot, and it's been able to be quite inclusive, but the only reason it's been able to get there is at the cost of others, at the cost of others whom it has excluded, and brutally so, in the form of conquest or colonization or enslavement. And the sobering statement that Wolf makes is that exclusion is perpetrated by the good and the just and the rational and the civilized. And I've given you the philosophers that he draws on for that. And yeah, that's quite a wake-up call, right? Because you kind of go into this chapter thinking, yes, let me read up about what all these other people are doing wrong. And one of Wolf's main points is, no, it's actually, it's you, the one who thinks he's the good guy. You're the one who practices exclusion. I'm the bad guy in the story. That's quite a wake-up call. And so Wolf basically goes that we are caught in almost like this, I think he calls it this impossible choice between not having boundaries on the one side, which leads to chaos, or having boundaries, which leads to oppression on the other side. So, you know, he sort of develops that because he was talking about Foucault, who saw people dealing in binaries and setting boundaries and going, no, we can't do that. So the answer's got to be is that we have this, I don't know, this indifferentiated thing in which we don't make judgment calls, don't have boundaries. But then Wolf says you can't go there because that leads to chaos. That's not the way of life. But on the other hand, as soon as you set boundaries, then inevitably those boundaries will be used to exclude and to oppress. And we don't really want to go there either. And so for those of us who are seeking to try and attain some level of inclusion, he says there are two dangers, even for those of us who are seeking to be inclusive. The one is that, you know, we're so passionate about wanting to be inclusive that we set up all sorts of new rules. And in the process, we create new forms of exclusion. Okay, so that basically we end up excluding in the name of inclusion. And the other danger is that we are aware of the first danger, but then we fall off on the other side where we sort of go, okay, you know, we can't make judgment calls. We can't do too many boundaries, and we fall into the abyss of non-order. He then also says, So if we are going to have any type of useful reflection on inclusion, it needs to be able to do two things. So on the one hand, it needs to be able to call evil evil and not be scared to do that. And as a result of that, also start to be able to visualize non-exclusionary boundaries. So that's a novel idea almost, a boundary that does not exclude. And on the other hand, a useful reflection on inclusion would also keep our ability to detect our exclusionary tendencies that we inevitably have. So he already sort of, I suppose, offers two pointers of hope or where we could be going with this. Then he moves on to definitions, and specifically these three terms, and basically says, look, in many circles, these three terms are seen as largely synonymous, and they're all seen as bad terms. Whereas he goes, no, what we should be doing is we should nuance that a little bit. And so Wolf basically turns the first one into a good term, the second one is a negative, and then the third one, well, it depends on how we hold the first two. It could come out good or bad. The first one, differentiation, he draws on God's creative activity in the creation account. And he says differentiation is our creative activity, in some ways mirroring God's, of separating and binding that results in patterns of interdependence. And the separating and binding is important. It's not just the one or the other. So God in the creation account, he separates but keeps bound together. He doesn't separate into disconnected bits. So they are patterns of interdependence. So that's a good thing to differentiate. But then the bad thing is to, and then also what he's then basically saying is that boundaries are okay, but barriers are not. So boundaries aren't in themselves bad. They can be good things, but when they act as barriers that prevent encounter, that's when they get bad. Then exclusion, though, is then the negative. It's the sinful activity of reconfiguring God's creation. And I might do that either by transgressing against the binding part or transgressing against the separating part. And there's a subsequent slide where we look at that in a bit more detail. And then judgment, I didn't sort of find him giving a definition of judgment, but basically judgment then is almost like the result of how we hold the first two. And what I do think I picked up is that he was at least hinting at having the courage to name evil, but also to have the humility to recognize our own fallibility and our tendencies to exclude. And I think if we can hold both of those, then we end up with good judgments, with non-exclusionary judgments. And then he asks an important question. He then says, yes, but what kind of a person can get that right, can actually make good judgments, the kind of judgments that are non-exclusionary? And I love the question because he doesn't ask, okay, by what technique do we get that right? Or, what's the method for this? He's asking what kind of a person can do this. So he's, I suppose, going down the road of virtue ethics a little bit. And then he explores this idea of the self and its center. And he goes, okay, somebody like Richard Rorty would say that the answer is a centerless self, because the problem is that the self is always trying to construct a center for itself, and then the ego gets in the way, and boundaries and whatever else, and judgments. And so basically the answer is a centerless self that's almost like, I suppose, doesn't care too much, or is able to keep an ironic distance to things. And then Wolf says, well, that's kind of impossible, because the self always has a center and is always in the business of finding a center for itself. So the issue isn't whether the self has a center or not. The issue is whether the center is the right one or the wrong one. And it's easy to have a wrong center. The solution, or the answer to that, of course, would be what he would call a decentered and also recentered self. How? Well, he says, by being crucified with Christ, the self has received a new center. The Christ who lives in it and with whom it lives. So in Christ, we are both decentered and recentered. And he also goes on just to be sure that to say that this does not mean an erasure of the self. Okay, so Christ lives in us, he lives with us, but he doesn't erase us. And I think this is important because I think we certainly come across theologies that actually speak about this erasure of the self. It's not an erasure. And then he also says at the center is self-giving love. So at the center of Christ is self-giving love. And therefore, as we de- and recenter around him, our center will be self-giving love. He talks about us then being firmly centered and radically open. Then the anatomy and dynamics of exclusion. He uses that by saying, look, exclusion isn't the only sin, isn't the original sin, it's not the root sin, but it's a very key sin. Much of sin involves the practice of exclusion, to the point that it's actually helpful to talk of sin as the practice of exclusion. And he also says, look, Jesus's main mission wasn't to be a prophet of inclusion or tolerance or something like that. But Jesus practiced inclusion big time. He embraced the outcast. But Jesus's mission was or is as the bringer of grace. And the way he does that is twofold. One is he renames, and secondly, he remakes. So he renames things. For example, people have called certain foods unclean, and he renamed that and he said, no foods are unclean. But then he also remakes people. So there are some things that are wrongly called unclean, but then there are some things that are truly unclean, and he makes them clean. That's us, right? And an important, very key statement here as well is just the realization that the source of the evil is internal, not external. So sin sometimes disguises itself as purity, as the kind of purity that wants the world out there cleansed, but not the heart inside. So, you know, clean up everything outside, but not inside of me. And this type of exclusion, says Wolf, often passes as virtue, especially in religious circles. And he then gives, I think I found four forms of exclusion. The first one, eliminates, he gives the example of, you know, genocide, wars, it's that sort of thing. It's excluding the other by eliminating the other. The second form is more subtle. It's exclusion by assimilation. So in that one, the powerful basically say to others, become like us, you know, be absorbed by us. Give up your identity. So you can see it's a form of exclusion because it expects the other to give up their identity. So this one says, look, if you allow us to swallow you up, we will not vomit you out, I think was one of the ways he expressed that. Then there's domination. The two examples he used there were apartheid in South Africa and the caste system in India. And then fourthly, abandonment. And there was something you said there that struck me, so that's why I've quoted it here. If others neither have goods we want, nor can perform services we need, we make sure that they are at a safe distance. And I was, the reason that struck me is that I was wondering, isn't that what we kind of, where we've gone in South Africa today? So yesterday was apartheid, and today I'm wondering whether that's where we've gone. So just a thought. Then he also makes the point that the practice of exclusion is frequently preceded by the language of exclusion. So we call people, cockroaches or sluts or lazy or whatever. And it's then almost like that language that then leads us to the practice. And then Wolf is pretty pretty harsh there because he says when we do that, you know, that cognitive thing, it's actually a very willful thing. So it's not just that we're being ignorant, we're being deliberate, we're being willful at naming and labeling and sloganeering in that way. And then what he also does is he sort of tries to make the link to emotions. So this is kind of like the head, heart, and hand slide, right? So on the one hand, we have what we think and say that leads to what we do. But obviously, what's also involved is our emotions and our feelings. And he says that has a both-way link to the language and practice of exclusion. So our exclusion calls forth emotional responses like hatred and indifference. But then again, that sort of hatred and indifference in turn sustains our language and practice of exclusion. So it's a kind of like a vicious circle here. And then he asks the question, why do we do that? Okay, why do we hate others, or why do we turn our eyes from them? And he looks at some possible responses, possible answers, partial answers. One of them is that maybe what's actually happening is that we actually hate ourselves, and we're just projecting that onto others then. And ourselves, that could be our individual selves or our collective selves. And we sort of almost like turn our hatred for ourselves into a hatred for the other. Or one reason could be that we have discomfort with anything that is other, because anything that's other, you know, it blurs our boundaries, it disturbs our identities. We just don't like that much. The third possible reason is that we desire what others have, and then we devise all sorts of strategies in order to get it. But ultimately, he says, these are partial answers, and ultimately he thinks there's no answer. It's a little bit like trying to answer where does evil come from. It's very difficult to try and get there. And I was wondering, again, how these sort of things are playing themselves out in South Africa today. So it would be interesting to do a present day analysis of South Africa, just using this slide. He then gets onto a section on what he calls contrived innocence. And he speaks about this glaring incongruity, where in a world that is so manifestly drenched with evil, everyone is innocent in their own eyes. And those who do accept the blame hasten to mount equal or greater blame on the shoulders of others. So that first option is the more crude option that sort of goes, you know, there's a lot of evil out there, but it wasn't me, I'm innocent. And the second option there is a little bit more nuanced. It says, yeah, I'm also at fault, but those other people, they're much more at fault. So that's the slightly more nuanced version of contriving one's innocence. And then he has a look at the dynamics of the perpetrator and the victim. Now, it's obviously easy to see how the perpetrator would contrive their innocence, and the perpetrator actually devises all sorts of ways in which they declare themselves innocent. And Wolf talks about a peculiar blend of fraud and self-deception. And but then when we get to the victim, I think Wolf sort of realizes this is tricky ground, because can we actually is the victim innocent? And you can see why this is tricky, because what we don't want to do is we don't want to go victim blaming, right? But Wolf sort of does ask some important questions. He says, for example, can victims actually sustain innocence in a world of violence? He says that, think of the dynamics, the evildoers, the perpetrators fashion victims in their own ugly image. And then inevitably yesterday's victims are today's perpetrators. So he makes the case for the fact that just because you're a victim doesn't mean that you are innocent. And then he also says, but aren't there third parties? Are there just perpetrators and victims? Surely a lot of us might want to identify as an onlooker or an activist or whatever. Surely they're innocent. And his answer to that is, well, look, they're not somehow divorced from what's happening or floating above it. Okay, they're immersed in the same world with the same conflicts. And so Therefore, inevitably, they too are themselves perpetrators and victims, and sometimes both at the same time. So I think the key take home from this slide is what Wolf calls the solidarity in sin, the idea that we are all sinners, whether we perpetrate a victim or other, we are all sinners. And then he goes on to emphasize that that doesn't mean that all sins are equal, because I mean, that would be the narrative of the perpetrator, right? That sort of goes, ah, we're all sinners, so there's no difference, so I can just be the perpetrator. And Wolf goes against that, and he says, yes, all are sinners, but that doesn't mean all sins are equal. So he is in no ways equating the perpetrator with the victim here. But so it's important, again, to hold that both and. We are all sinners, but not all sins are equal. And this is just straight from the book, some advantages, some, you know, what does it help us to recognize the solidarity in sin, that we are all sinners? Well, four that I picked up, it frees us from illusions of perfectibility. So whether it's our own perfectibility or our institutions, it pricks the balloons of self-righteousness. It protects all of us from perpetuating evil in the name of good. And then that last one, I found that quite profound. It helps us to see that no salvation can be expected from an approach that rests on the moral assignment of blame and innocence. So basically, if we keep dealing in those binaries, don't expect to be getting anywhere, is what I think he's saying. And so he says the wrong question to ask then is to ask, you know, how do we locate innocence and how do we work towards it? And the right question to ask rather is, how do we live with integrity and bring healing to a world that is inescapably not innocent? And the answer he gives to the question, in the name of the one truly innocent victim, we should demask exclusive moral polarities, because we know about the universality of sin. So we know we can't, talk in the binaries of, you know, us good, them bad or something. We need to demask that because we understand about the universality of sin. But then also we seek to transform. He uses words like reconciliation, embrace, because we've been gotten a hold of by the primacy of grace. And so Wolf says at the core of the Christian faith, again, this is quite profound, is that others need not be perceived as innocent in order to be loved, but ought to be embraced even when they are perceived as wrongdoers. And you can again see, I think, in that statement, just how it, we can get there because we understand the universality of sin and the primacy of grace. Others need not be perceived as innocent in order to be loved, but ought to be embraced even when they are perceived as wrongdoers. Then the power of exclusion. And I'm just going to have a slide on the system and a slide on the self. So he talks about the system of exclusion. This is my attempt of trying to draw it in a diagram. He speaks about the background cacophony of evil that's there all the time. So there's just this, you know, a low intensity background evil that we live in and live with all the time. And we call it the way things work or the way things are. But then under extraordinary situations and also extraordinary directors, I think he means a both and, both need to be present. Some of that is played up. So it's no longer kept as background music. It's now brought to the foreground. So some narrative is being told or some slogan is being thrown. And he gives a list of, the suspects of who would do that. And after it's sort of been played up in that way, then all it needs is some spark, some trigger, somebody to fire that first shot, and a chain reaction erupts of a uncontrollable evil. And this is actually a quite a almost like depressing thing to read. He speaks, for example, of observing an insatiable appetite for brutality in ordinary and even decent people. So that's quite scary, actually. The other thing that's quite scary is that if you sort of rewind a bit and you don't know yet where it's going, you can't actually properly see it coming. Because the way it's played up is that the narratives that are being told, they're playing on our hopes and our fears, and they are designed to strengthen our faith in ourselves and our hope in the future, and they play with our sense of identity and belonging. And it's constructed in a way that the illusion is created that all is still well. So to me, as I said, this is quite scary that it's actually, it's not easy to see this thing coming. And then in terms of the self, so the previous slide was external, now we go internal. He basically leans on Romans 7, this thing about I don't do the good I want to do, etc. And he says the self is split into the weaker self that does know and want the good, but also the stronger self that is dominated by sin. And he says that an evil not only inhabits us, which affects our actions, it even colonizes us and affects our will. And he again asks the question, why do we let evil or sin do that to us? And he wrestles with some answers that that have been given. But he then also already starts to, look forward in terms of giving us some hope. And he says our hope lies in the spirit and recentering the self. Remember that? In the image of the self-giving Christ. And as it does that, as the spirit does that, our will is freed so that we can resist the power of exclusion in the power of the spirit of embrace. And you can see how he's starting to line up the next chapter on embrace there. And then if that's what it does to us internally, then ultimately it also empowers us to fight the external bits, the system of exclusion. And then the last section, I wasn't exactly sure where he was going. And perhaps he was just lining up the next chapter, but he was talking about Cain's assault. But I think his point there also being, Cain and Abel in some ways are representative of us all. Every one of us can be Cain and Abel. And he's just basically then analyzes how sin functions in that story. So he looks at the logic of sin, how Cain basically rationalizes, gives himself a good reason why he should murder his brother. He talks about the geography of sin, so that basically, the crime scene here is outside of the public sphere where, nobody notices, nobody can stop what's happening. That's the geography of sin. And then also the ideology of sin. If you then look at the subsequent interaction between Cain and God, what Cain is doing, he's denying both the act and the responsibility for it. And then obviously the consequences of sin, that basically Cain, by his own act of exclusion, gets to exclude himself from the land, from people, from God. But luckily, that doesn't have to be the end of the story. But there is grace. So God puts a mark on Cain to protect him as a potential victim, not to brand him as a perpetrator. That's something we sometimes miss. And God does not abandon Cain to the cycle of exclusion he himself has set in motion. And then if we fast forward the story a little bit, especially Cain as representative, Cain's hope is to be drawn near and embraced by the crucified. But the embrace of the crucified, says Wolf, will only heal him if he learns to love the one who embraced him. Good. That's the summary leading us, hopefully, to a time of good discussion.